From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. The COVID-19 pandemic has shut down many of North Carolina's businesses. You'll hear from one business owner. He says regulators rejected safety measures that would have allowed him to keep his doors open. State lawmakers have been wrestling with the best way to tax online education material. You'll hear highlights from their debate. Before the pandemic, a chief foreign policy debate involved American relations with Iran. You'll hear one expert's analysis of a program of maximum pressure on the Islamic Republic. And we'll discuss the Carolina Rebound Project's recommendations for reforming North Carolina regulations. Speaking of Carolina Rebound, Donna Martinez focuses on another piece of that project. She has the Carolina Journal headline.
When North Carolina's public schools open their doors in August, educators are going to be facing all sorts of challenges. Learning loss for the kids is just one of those challenges. And of course, there will be issues for parents and for the kids as well. This new environment requires us to rethink how we deliver education to kids. And our next guest says there are lots and lots of ways to give parents the alternatives and the flexibility that they're now looking for. It's all laid out in Carolina Rebound, which is a policy guide for state policymakers to follow as they work to revive our state. It is created and authored by the researchers of the John Locke Foundation. You can find it at johnlocke.org. Dr. Terry Stoops is the Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies for the Locke Foundation. He authored the education portion of Carolina Rebound. He joins us now to talk about that. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
COVID-19, huge impact on education. Give us a sense of what you've seen over the past several months.
Initially, there was a lot of confusion about how the schools would go about delivering instruction, the role of parents in helping their child with instruction, and just very basic things like attendance, transportation, school lunches. These were all issues that really vexed a lot of educators and a lot of schools. And over the last few weeks, as school has wound down, I think that a lot of schools started to hit their stride in recognizing how to make all these things work and recognizing, too, that it was just going to be temporary to end the school year, looking forward to the summer and start to anticipate how they would start planning for the fall.
Let's talk a little bit more about the challenge that an educator will face in the fall. How do you know, Terry, where your kids stand in terms of what they know and what they don't know, what they learned, what they didn't learn? What are your recommendations for educators?
We don't know because state testing was canceled. And it was waived by the federal government, so there was no federal or state requirement that states administer tests. North Carolina asked for a waiver and was granted one, so we did not administer state tests. So one of my recommendations is that since we don't know what students know and don't know, is that once they get back into the classroom in whatever form that will take, whether it's online or in person, that the state make tests available, the state tests available to teachers so they could administer to their students and use them as a diagnostic tool to determine where the students stand. If they're using the state tests, they're already made. They would just need to be scored. They wouldn't cost any additional money for the school districts, and it would give them a common tool to use to be able to determine how much remedial work some students will need and whether those students are on grade level or not.
Terry, in Carolina Rebound, you focus a lot on the value that a really effective teacher will bring to a classroom, particularly in the post-COVID-19 period, where, as we said, lots and lots of challenges. And you have some recommendations about making sure that the teachers who really perform well are compensated.
That's absolutely right. And if you think about it, we really want to make sure that the teachers who are doing a fantastic job with students that have had learning loss get compensated accordingly. So let's say that you're a student and you're entering a classroom and you're one or two grades behind, and you have a teacher that's able to make up that gap. That is a significant achievement. And one of the ways that the state should reward that achievement is to provide some sort of salary supplement for that teacher. I think it's imperative that we provide the kind of incentives that would be necessary to make sure that the teachers in our classroom not only are high quality, but that they stay in the classroom. That's one of the biggest reasons why we should have any sort of pay incentive, is to make sure high quality teachers stay in the classroom, and we should reward them for being the high quality teachers that they are, specifically those teachers that are able to make up for the learning loss.
One of the curious byproducts of this pandemic has been that parents and kids who normally would have never been interested in or thought to choose a virtual environment or an environment different than a traditional bricks and mortar school and a traditional public school classroom have now been exposed to alternatives. And in Carolina Rebound, you talk about school choice and giving parents and kids more options. What are you recommending?
Well, we all have our preconceived notions about things like online education, and as a parent, I could tell you that many of mine were akin to having a child surf the web for all day. But virtual instruction is very structured, very rigorous, and one of the reasons why I think many parents are going to start gravitating toward it is because they realize this is a very structured, very successful way of delivering instruction. And so I think that as a state, we need to expand it as much as possible. Now, we have two full-time virtual charter schools in North Carolina, but there are caps on both of those schools. And that's going to really be a barrier to parents who want to pursue full-time online education for their child. And so one of my recommendations is to get rid of those caps. But that is just a one step toward making sure that we have a school system that maximizes flexibility. We don't know how many children are going to be back in the classroom. We don't know whether parents are going to choose their conventional, their traditional school, or some sort of alternative like a charter home or private school. And so we really need to prepare for whatever comes this fall. And the way to do that is to maximize flexibility by expanding educational opportunities for all kids. Not just those that may have been disproportionately affected by COVID, but for all North Carolina students.
You're really talking about innovations, and you actually have a section on innovation in Carolina Rebound, and it's pretty interesting. One of the items is granting calendar flexibility. We have heard so much discussion about this in North Carolina, about when should a school be required to open, required to close, number of days, et cetera. And you are essentially asking everyone, policymakers in particular, to step back, open their minds a bit.
North Carolina has one of the most rigid school calendar laws of any state in the nation, one of the only states to dictate a start and end date for public school students. Now, charter schools don't have those kind of restrictions, and one of the things that I reason is that if it's good enough for a charter school, it should be good enough for our districts as well. The General Assembly did allow schools to start early. For the upcoming year, they can start as early as August 17th, but there are still pretty rigid school calendar law in place. And this is something that the North Carolina House has for years tried to change to give more flexibility to districts. And I think we're going to start seeing more receptiveness to that in the Senate for those who may have been reluctant to provide more school calendar flexibility, to go ahead and start thinking along those lines.
Terry, we've also seen from COVID-19 a realization, not with you because you have always written about this, but a realization for some that the broadband question and the access to high-speed internet and laptops, et cetera, really is an issue for some kids. And you write about that in Carolina Rebound.
That's right. We should not ignore it. It is an issue. There are not only students, but teachers that don't have sufficient broadband access. And so I think really the key is to work with the private sector providers and see what technologies are available and what their needs are to be able to provide what many call the last mile broadband, so that all students have access to it. I think a permanent solution is to consider the ways that the private sector can provide broadband to anyone who needs it, and then see what public assistance would be necessary to provide it for those who can't afford it.
We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies for the Locke Foundation. Terry, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly. But our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The COVID-19 pandemic prompted governments across the country to shut down businesses. That's creating plenty of turmoil for workers and business owners. A recent John Locke Foundation online forum highlighted the challenges COVID-19 has presented for North Carolina businesses. Steve Pinkerton owns Vitality Fitness in Concord.
There's a mental health aspect of this that I think is really getting kind of kicked to the side. We looked at this and said, okay, well, maybe we can appeal to the Department of Revenue and let them take it on a case-by-case basis. And we provided as thorough of a plan as I could put into place that covered everything from taking people's temperature when they come in, having a log that I can submit that tracks symptoms. We can also have, you know, we've got this relationship with a company called Venture Management and Reconstruction, who travels the country and does these remediation in senior living facilities. They disinfect these facilities. If someone gets sick in a property, they would go in, they would completely disinfect and make that property livable again and safe for those residents. So they actually are co-located in the complex we run out of, and they agreed to provide a weekly service. We got this entire protocol that they do, and we went above and beyond to provide this to our building here and provide the background to the Department of Revenue so they could see this and see that the steps we're willing to take and the costs that were associated with it. Because that's another thing. When businesses do reopen, they're going to also have this amazing increase in cleaning supplies and cleaning costs to follow these guidelines. For us, we just wanted to say, okay, we're going to go ahead and bite this off. We'll do it on a weekly basis. We'll get our doors back open.
Pinkerton says he developed a plan for state officials.
We submitted it, and it was probably 4.5 pages. I'm not the smartest guy. The Marine Corps gave me a lot of skills, but writing stuff like that is not my strong suit. But we made it. We put a pretty concise document together that laid out exactly what our plan was. And I got the cookie cutter response that said we are not deemed essential. But oh, by the way, the ABC liquor store down the road, they're essential. It's a frustrating thing when it's just so obvious the double standard. So here we are closed, going on about 45 days, and being closed, being a membership, recurring membership model, this is not what you want to see happen.
How does Pinkerton stay calm as his business remains closed?
When I left the Marine Corps, I wasn't as calm as I am now. But then I had my first daughter 12 years ago, and that changed the game for me. And then I had my second daughter 6 years ago. So now I've got two girls and my wife. So I've gotten a little better at taking orders and being bossed around. So I've been training for this for the last 12 years. I just didn't know it. It's the perfect scenario. You take someone who is an entrepreneur. He was given a set of parameters, and he was able to adjust to those and do the best he can with the cards that he was given. And all I was asking for was, you can put whatever stipulations you want on me, but allow me to open my business, and then I will be creative. These entrepreneurs, these small business owners, I think we're really good problem solvers, but you've got to give us the ability to open up and be able to solve the problem, and then we'll come up with creative ways to stay within the guidelines and keep our people employed and provide the service that that we offer. And that's the hard part, that we're just not getting that opportunity. And I'm watching. I've done this for 11 years now, and I think, again, I go back to this the mental health portion of this, where people need that outlet. The amount of stress and fear and anxiety that's getting spread around is massive. And there's everyone's going to cope with that in their own way.
You're listening to Steve Pinkerton, owner of Vitality Fitness in Concord. He's speaking during a recent John Locke Foundation online forum. Pinkerton says a fitness center like his could play a role in helping people cope with the pandemic.
That's the most healthy way to do this. And if we're not going to give people this outlet, we're not going to provide them this ability, they're going to go find another way to cope with this. And there's a lot worse ways, whether it's alcohol or medicine or pills or whatever, people are going to find a way to cope with this. And my thing is, let's provide them a healthy outlet to deal with all of this information that's getting, you know, fire hose in their face every time they turn on the TV.
Pinkerton did not oppose the initial shutdown of his business and others.
I don't think anybody, me included, when the order to shelter in place for 30 days came out, I understood. I said, okay, there's not enough information out. It makes sense. And I was supportive of it. And we put a plan in place. And then you start seeing these numbers come out, and I am not a doctor, and I have no background to talk intelligently about any of it. But when you really look at the numbers that are important, the metrics that are important, not the metrics that they try and fool you with on TV, we're to the point now where this is a different view than what we were 35 to 40 days ago. And I wish that they could separate these metrics and you could intelligently look at them and start to change what we have, the kind of the viewpoint of it. But I don't know. I don't know if there's an, I think we're the minority of people that are not as afraid of this as the majority is, and the majority's voice is what we're hearing.
Pinkerton explains why he worries about more than just his own business and his own employees.
I spent 5 years making sure my business, my building could get occupied, and we were 100% occupied. And now all of a sudden I've taken these very vulnerable businesses, and now I'm in a position to where maybe I can't charge the same amount of rent. Maybe I have to come up with some type of deferral program. Maybe these businesses can't stay afloat. And now all of a sudden, if I lose a tenant now, there's not a long line of small business owners that are like, well, I'm going to go invest into a new space and expand out. So now you're going to have this empty space, and the trickle down effect is going to get pretty important here as it comes time to for these businesses to reopen. And if they are going to reopen, because our building is fairly empty. I've got a hair salon that has obviously been closed, a yoga studio that's closed, a dance studio that's closed down, so a corporate offices. And I've got a big church that comes in here and rents from me on the weekends. So all these businesses are closed, and it puts a ton of pressure on all this effort that I put into the last 5 years to get these people in and situated, to now their businesses may not be able to open back up.
Does Pinkerton have a message for North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper?
I would just hope that he could recognize the fact that we can be an integral part in making sure that we can provide a service to people so that they can become healthier. I look at how much more dangerous this virus is to people with underlying health conditions. Well, one of the ways we're going to create more of that is keeping people at home, telling them they can't go anywhere, telling them that, you know, they can. The parks were closed here for a while. Now I think they're back open again. But if we keep people in, they're only going to get they're not going to focus on their health. They're not going to focus on getting themselves in a position to where if it's flu season or whatever is going to come up next, this won't be the last thing that comes down the pipe that unhealthy people are going to be vulnerable with. And we need to be able to provide that service to people. So I would hope that he can recognize the fact that health and wellness will be one of the ways to combat this. And we can do that in a very safe way. And he gives us the ability to do that and operate the way that we've been operating for 11 years.
That's Steve Pinkerton, owner of Vitality Fitness in Concord. He's discussing business challenges created by the government's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina lawmakers are wrestling with the topic of taxing online education materials. They don't want to tax schools, but what about private groups with online tutorials? What about other for-profit ventures with online components? Draft legislation would distinguish among those cases. Senator Paul Newton explains the goal.
Our policy goal here was to try to unburden education from taxation. We don't want to tax people's desire to improve themselves, to improve their jobs, to improve their station in life. So that's what this bill is trying to accomplish, with the sort of counterbalance recognition that there are national groups out there, companies out there that are selling sort of self-improvement online courses. And I think it seems like everything here, once you start getting into it, is much more complicated in actual practice than it is in theory. But I think they've done a great job trying to balance that interest. And again, we're going to work through this bill attempting to unburden any true sort of educational development and achievement, make sure we're not taxing that for folks.
Fellow Republican Senator Jerry Tillman offered his colleagues a word of caution. He worries about a complicated tax code.
One of our goals in finance going back a few years was to simplify the tax laws. Now, we've done a good job, I think, in trying to unhook all these things here that apply and don't apply to the sales tax. But I'm afraid in doing so, we have complicated this quite a bit. And I don't know how to simplify it, but I know we'll spend a year, you all staff and DOR, in explaining the complexity of this, to who it applies to, who it doesn't apply to. So I got a feeling we may come back to this issue once we see all of the questions that are coming, but they will be coming on this one.
Representative Julia Howard responded to Tillman's concerns. She realizes the current proposal is a work in progress.
Those of us who've been trying to work through this draft realize that this is a work in progress. And as times change and things change, we do anticipate this is our first try to get something out there, and we hope we can get it right, but anticipating that things change and times change, we anticipate that we'll be coming back to readdress this and some of the other issues.
You've been listening to highlights from a recent legislative debate. Lawmakers are considering changing state tax law linked to online education materials. The current proposal distinguishes between schools and for-profit companies. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. Does it make sense for the American government to place maximum pressure on Iran? It's a topic Michael Rubin of the American Enterprise Institute recently addressed in Chapel Hill. Rubin was delivering a lecture for the Jesse Helms Center.
It's amazing when you just look at the big picture with regard to the Islamic Republic of Iran, that they have effectively been at war with us for more than 40 years. And they say so directly. And yet, never has a country been so wrapped in Teflon to not be held accountable for so many of its actions. It astounds me that when Secretary of State Mike Pompeo comes in and implements a maximum pressure campaign against Iran, the knee-jerk reaction to that is to try to exculpate Iran from its behaviors, to blame those behaviors on American pressure, or to suggest that the opposite, not pressure, but an embrace of Iran, could somehow repair the relations.
Rubin says history tells a different story about the best way to deal with Iran.
There's certain things which are simply sheer facts. In 1993, Klaus Kinkel, the German foreign minister, came into office, and he said that we're going to take a different approach to Iran. We want to show that the American style of cowboy diplomacy and unilateralism isn't going to work. Instead, we are going to have critical engagement, where we are going to shower the Iranian government with trade and try to bring them back into the international community. Now, between 1998 and 2005, at the height of the so-called critical engagement, you had European Union trade with Iran triple, and you had the price of oil quintuple. The Iranians took about 70% of that hard currency windfall and invested it in nuclear technology, which at the time was covert, as well as their ballistic missile programs. Meanwhile, by any metric which the Europeans were looking at Iran, human rights and so forth, and the other topics, not sponsoring terrorist groups, the other topics which they had used as justification for their new approach. They achieved absolutely nothing. Quite the contrary, you actually have had a consistent backsliding in Iran.
Another complicating factor, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. It plays a huge role in the Iranian economy, regardless of official government funding.
If the Iranians were to have an epiphany and say, admit that the Revolutionary Guard is a terrorist organization and bring its official budget to zero, proportionately, they would still be facing less of a budget cut than we did through sequestration. Because the huge bulk, 90% of their income, comes from outside the normal budgetary process. And this is why this idea of flooding Iran with trade, or during the Obama administration, giving this sort of sanctions relief and believing somehow that it was going to trickle down and benefit ordinary people, it just doesn't work.
That's Michael Rubin, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, recent speaker in Chapel Hill for the Jesse Helms Center. Rubin addressed critics of plans to pressure Iran.
A lot of the opponents of the maximum pressure campaign will say two things. First of all, because the Revolutionary Guard is so involved in smuggling, if you actually have sanctions, it empowers the Revolutionary Guard. And to some extent, there's something to that. But the other thing they will say is that maximum pressure can never work. The Iranians are too proud. Well, I'm sorry. History shows that that's simply not the case. Maximum pressure has worked on the Islamic Republic of Iran. You all remember the hostage crisis that started during the Carter administration. It didn't, by the way, start with the Islamic Revolution. There was more than 9 months between when the Islamic Revolution happened and when the hostage crisis started. And there was an additional 5 months before the Carter administration broke diplomatic relations with Iran, believe it or not. Why did the embassy seizure happen? It was because of diplomatic dialogue. And Zbigniew Brzezinski, Carter's national security advisor, had gone over to Algiers. He met the Iranian prime minister, and he said publicly, shook hands, and he said publicly he hoped that we could find a way to continue to work in order to once again become allies. Someone snapped a picture of this. It was put on all the front page of the papers, and this notion, this conspiracy that the prime minister of the Islamic Republic was about to betray the revolution that led the students to seize the American embassy. It wasn't done because the American embassy was there, because the American embassy had been there for 9 months already. It was done because we were trying, and the Carter administration was trying to force diplomacy at a time when the political instability inside Iran was such that people wanted to act as spoilers. Well, needless to say, you know the rest. 52 American hostages were held for 444 days. When the hostages were released on the first day of the Reagan presidency, you had a lot of the alumni of the Carter administration say that this was because of the persistence of diplomacy, that we should not credit Ronald Reagan for their release. The late, great Peter Rodman wrote an article back in 1981 in the Washington Journal, who said, no, all these Carter administration aides have it backwards. The reason why the Iranians released the hostages was simply because the cost of holding them became too great to bear. With terrorism, it's a tactic, and there's always a cost-benefit analysis to it. And he made the cost-benefit analysis that continuing to hold these hostages, especially with the specter of someone like Reagan coming into office, as opposed to the hapless Carter, was simply too great to bear. Maximum pressure worked.
Rubin cautioned against relying on pressure alone.
Well, maximum pressure has a role. How do you actually fracture the Revolutionary Guard? After all, I mean, you can put a lot of pain on Iranian society and people. You can put a lot of pain on North Korea. But the nature of dictatorships is they really don't care about the welfare of their people. So one of the things I would suggest that we should be doing is, for example, we have hospital ships in the U.S. Navy, the USNS Comfort, for example. It wouldn't cost much money to send it to Dubai or Abu Dhabi and offer Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps veterans free medical care. If they come and they take it, that's a propaganda coup for us, an intelligence coup. If they don't take it, that just sows greater divisions within the Revolutionary Guard, and that, I would argue, is worthwhile.
Rubin also suggests shaming the progressive left and European Greens into supporting labor unionization in Iran and using Voice of America to highlight stories from Iranian newspapers about day-to-day problems within the country. Carolina Journal Radio caught up with Rubin after his speech.
Your basic point was about the fact that maximum pressure on Iran can work under certain circumstances. How so?
Maximum pressure is all about raising the cost to Iran's behavior. And we've seen several times in the past that when the cost of Iran's behavior gets too great, the Iranian leadership will change its mind, even if they've sworn never to do so.
What do Americans not know about this situation that we should know?
When it comes to the approach to Iran, it's important to understand two things. First of all, the Iranian people and the Iranian regime are two different things. Most of the Iranian people have given up on the regime, but it's the guys with the guns that matter. The key thing to understand is just how powerful the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps has become, not only militarily, but also politically and economically. So you're not really going to have any change in Iran until you do something about the Revolutionary Guard.
That's Michael Rubin, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, speaking recently in Chapel Hill. He delivered the Admiral James W. Nance Lecture for the Jesse Helms Center. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Red tape has always been a problem, whether for average North Carolinians trying to practice their trade or skill to earn a living, or for business owners trying to deliver a product or a service to customers at a profit. But as we look past the COVID-19 pandemic, these impediments will be intolerable as people try to recapture their lives and renew their livelihoods. Now, the plan forward for reviving North Carolina's economy and rejecting the barriers that hinder that rebound is laid out in Carolina Rebound, which is a major policy report from the researchers here at the John Locke Foundation. You can read it all at johnlocke.org. John Sanders is Director of Regulatory Studies for the Locke Foundation. He authored one piece, a big piece of this report, Carolina Rebound. He joins us now to talk about it. John, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Donna. Thanks for having me.
You focus in on some really vital matters as we look to the future and hopefully a revived North Carolina economy. And the first thing you write about, John, is about making it easier for people to get back to work. Tell us why you focused in on that first.
Main focus for that is because the economy was not built for businesses to be shut down for 2 to 3 months. That is going to create a huge problem going forward for people to get back to work, to earn a living. And so this calls for strong measures to help people get back to work. So this is not a time for playing games and pretending like things are the way they have always been. If the governor wants to talk about a new normal, this is the new normal. We have got to get people back to work. We've got to remove all these government impediments to people getting back to work, and we can't play favorites.
Let's talk about a big one that you say is a major barrier that really needs to be torn down. And here's the opportunity as we're looking for ways to quickly and efficiently try to get people back to work. You're talking about what's known as occupational licensing. First, just briefly explain what that is and how that can be a real impediment to someone finding a job.
Oh, occupational licensing is the most extreme regulation on a legal occupation that government can make. It is it's an entry barrier. It says you cannot even start work in your field unless you have been licensed by the government, which means you've got to satisfy education requirements, you've got to satisfy experience requirements, you've got to maybe take a certain number of tests, and you've got to pay your fees. And a lot of these things are not necessary. And as the COVID crisis started, it became pretty clear that even licensing for nurses that other states had that we didn't were not as necessary. We waived licensing requirements and allowed the state to honor other states' licenses to get these people here. Well, I see this as something that we need to look at across the board for licensed occupations.
And John, one would think that if something works well in an emergency situation, if you recognize that you need to kind of clear the pathway in order to get people, in the case of the nurses you mentioned, medical care that we needed, one would think that going forward, policymakers would say, you know what, it worked then during COVID, so let's not put that back in place. But yet you're going to have people who say, we need to be really careful about public health and public safety. What do you say to them?
Well, and that's the interesting thing about licensing is that it's a bipartisan issue that everyone seems to agree on, left and right. I mean, one of the strongest cases for freeing up states from licensing came from the Obama White House in 2016. It's a special interest problem. So when reforms come about, they marshal their forces and are help beat it back. So I'm arguing now it's no longer time to listen to these special interests. We need to be paying attention to the people who need to get their jobs and need to get their lives back in order.
Well, John, when people go back to work, many of them are working for businesses, large and small. And you also focus in your portion of Carolina Rebound, on rules and regulations that you say, look, once again, they are too heavy-handed. We can do away with some of these things in order to revive our economy. What would you get rid of first?
Several things I would like to do. First of all, I'd like to have small business regulatory flexibility analysis. Most states have it. The federal government has it. North Carolina is one of the very few that doesn't. What this does is it recognizes that compliance costs and all the bureaucratic paperwork is very difficult for small businesses with few people on staff to comply with. So it allows waiving of some of those requirements, requiring fewer papers to come in, fewer reports. So it's a common sense thing. Another would be to limit the amount of regulations and find ways to cut with a reg tape regulation review committee, red tape reduction committee, speed up periodic review and sunset of regulations. We've had good success in that, but that's once every 10 years, and I'd like to see it done once every 5 years. We're in a much faster environment.
And people who maybe don't manage or own a business might not realize how much of this kind of stuff goes on and how it impacts a business. And I can recall early on during the COVID pandemic, I read a story of a local business owner who had about a dozen employees or so said that it was so sadly ironic that his business had been shut down by Governor Cooper's statewide shutdown order, and yet he had just paid like some local taxes and fees, et cetera, and he wasn't even able to operate. And his comment to a reporter was, how is that possible? I'm paying for the privilege of doing business here, and yet the government then comes in and says, no, you can't.
Well, we saw multiple places across the United States and in North Carolina where regulations and red tape were waived to deal with the onset of this virus crisis. And so on Twitter and elsewhere, the phrase never needed was brought up, which was to stress the fact that, look, if we don't need these things in an emergency, we certainly don't need them afterwards.
John, you also write in Carolina Rebound about the issue of broadband and connectivity, and we certainly have seen that in the forefront here during the pandemic, particularly when it comes to how public education moved completely online. But this is an issue in the medical field as well. And what do you think is the step forward when it comes to connectivity that would allow the free market and private actors to go out and serve customers, but at the same time, ensure that people have access to what they need?
Well, again, as I see it, the main feature is to waive regulations. The temptation will be to have government build the broadband for everybody, but those things have habitually proven to be failures and costly. We certainly don't need to be adding cost on people unnecessarily, but we can remove red tape and allow for building on utility rights away and other municipal rights away, and allow the private sector to innovate. I've seen innovation in the last couple of years where these small broadband companies are even putting up infrastructure on sweet gum trees and other natural things.
Well, it's an amazing piece of this big report, Carolina Rebound. It is a game plan for reviving North Carolina's economy as we head out of the pandemic. John Sanders is the Director of Regulatory Studies for the John Locke Foundation. He authored a portion of this report. And by the way, you can read this report at johnlocke.org. Sections on red tape and regulations, also on education, healthcare, taxes, and fiscal issues as well. John, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
That's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.